Several months ago, I delivered a sermon about a bishop in the Episcopal Church named John Shelby Spong. What that sermon was, in reality, was a sort of book report on the most famous and controversial of Spong's 17 books, which is entitled Why Christianity Must Change or Die. I received more response from that sermon than from any sermon I've delivered from this pulpit, and the response was almost all positive. When a small group of people from this congregation learned that Bishop Spong was conducting a week-long seminar at the Chautauqua Institution in New York, they offered to send Lee, Corinne, and me there for the week. And so it was that we canceled our plans for a very modest vacation and spent one of the most wonderful weeks of our lives in what is undoubtedly one of the most unique and beautiful settings to be found anywhere. I will have a lot to say about Bishop Spong, whom I had the honor of meeting, and I very much look forward to letting you all know how this remarkable and, I would say, inspired man envisions the future of the church. But that is going to have to wait for another day. There is simply too much to say on that subject for a single sermon. I've already started writing my thoughts, and I'm trying to put together a sort of outline from which I can organize Spong's thinking and present it to you in an intelligible form over a couple of weeks. I hope to have that ready by the end of summer. As for those of you who heard my first sermon on Spong, you already know what he is saying is very controversial and very important, too important to throw together in a single week. But as you can tell by the title of today's sermon, What I Did on My Summer Vacation, I do want to tell you about our trip. I'm hesitant about this for a couple of reasons. First, I don't believe the person who stands in the pulpit should ever be the subject of the sermon. I feel free to discuss Jesus, God, every religion under the sun, and for that matter, every topic that could possibly arise in the living of our lives, but I don't think it's right to stand here and talk about myself. Second, talking about my vacation from the pulpit is sort of like showing home movies to a very captive audience. And let's face it, we've all been in that situation, and after a couple of hours watching Billy the Wonder Baby splashing around in the backyard pool is great for parents and grandparents, but for the rest of us, it wears a little thin. The reason I'm making an exception to my rule today is that the speakers I heard at Chautauqua were amazing, and I want to make you aware of these people. And I also want to make you aware of the Chautauqua Institution, an amazing and unique place. Before I take you vicariously to Chautauqua, however, I want to mention a few things about the rest of the trip. First, let me confess that I used to have a fear of flying. I was literally a white-knuckled traveler. I got over that when my position with ITT led to my flying what seemed like constantly. But it had been about 3 years since I'd flown, and I had a few butterflies as we made our way to the gate in Kansas City. When I looked outside and saw that the plane we were about to board was what I call a puddle jumper, a small commuter-style plane, those butterflies started flapping their wings a little harder. And when I saw a woman of about 30 approach the counter in a blue uniform with a gold stripe on the sleeve, I assumed she was the pilot. Now, hopefully, you all know me well enough to know I have every confidence that women can fly every bit as skillfully as men. But I couldn't help noticing this young lady's eyes were bloodshot. And when she let out the biggest, longest yawn I have ever seen in my life, those butterflies in my stomach were flapping so hard they almost picked me up off the ground. I'd really been looking forward to this vacation, but now this punchline to a joke kept running through my mind, the one that goes, "But other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?" My anxiety soon disappeared when we boarded the plane and I discovered that the yawning woman was in fact the stewardess and not the pilot. I don't know or care if the actual pilot was male or female, but whoever it was seems to have been wide awake, and the rest of my butterflies disappeared when I realized that the puddle jumper we boarded was in fact a sleek little jet with Rolls-Royce engines that cruised in excess of 520 miles per hour. It was a great plane and a great flight. Because Niagara Falls is only a little over an hour from Chautauqua, everybody who heard we were going to be in that part of the country told us we should not miss it, and they were right. We spent a day there, and I actually had one of those rare transcendent moments while at the falls. I think we have all had a few rare occasions when we have one of these moments, and they are impossible to describe, but that's not going to stop me from trying. We were on a boat called Maid of the Mist, and we're pulling away from the bottom of Horseshoe Falls, where we had motored stunningly close to that thunderous wall of water. As the roar filled our ears and the mist blew against our faces and poured down our raincoats, I looked up to see that immense volume of water seemingly pouring right out of the sky. As I did, a couple of seagulls flew through my field of vision. And at that very moment, I noticed in my line of sight a vapor trail from a jet airplane cutting across the sky and disappearing into a rainbow formed by the mist being thrown from the top of the falls. The gulls, the water, the sky, the rainbow, the vapor trail, and just for a moment that probably lasted a couple of seconds, but might as well have lasted forever, everything was in perfect balance, and I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And the words of the medieval mystic, Julian of Norwich, which I had read only the night before, seemed to fill my ears along with the crashing roar of the water. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of thing will be well. And now Chautauqua. I don't know how to convey what the Chautauqua Institution is. Our daughter Corinne fell in love with the place, but she did not like the name from the start. She thought it sounded too much like an insane asylum, the Chautauqua Institution. And she questioned the motives of the people who sent us there. Chautauqua started in the 19th century as a sort of utopian experiment, and in many ways it is frozen in time. Walking the beautiful streets, and that's the only way to get around, walking or bicycling, you get the strong impression that you have wandered through some sort of time warp and have landed in an immaculate and beautifully tended Victorian village. It is stunningly beautiful. Historian David McCullough describes Chautauqua with these words: "There is no place like it, no resort, no spa, not anywhere else in the country or anywhere else in the world. It is at once a summer encampment and a small town, a college campus, an arts colony, a music festival, a religious retreat, and the village square. And there's no place, no place with anything like its history." Nora Tubbs Tisdale, the professor of preaching and worship at Princeton Theological Seminary, led us in worship every morning, and our friend Bishop Spong stirred things up in the afternoon. In between those two came a variety of speakers who were absolutely amazing. Chautauqua has a different theme each week during the summer. The week we were there, the theme was science and technology as engines of change. Frankly, it feels a bit odd to wander through those serene and beautiful Victorian streets, walk into a 130-year-old open-air amphitheater seating 5,000 people, and then hear some of the most intelligent, far-sighted, and mind-blowing speakers ever to cast their gaze upon the future and speculate about what that future holds. Each of them, in some way, impacted my thinking, and the residual effect of having spent so much time around them will undoubtedly filter into my sermons from this point forward. But for now, I want to briefly introduce you to four of those speakers. The first two speakers deal with that strange, almost surreal world of astronomy and physics, and the second two deal with the more down-to-earth issues of biology and medicine. First, there is Kitty Ferguson. To be truthful, I wasn't expecting too much from this speaker, and the problem is her name. The only Kitty I had ever heard of was the lady who ran the bar on the television show Gunsmoke. So somewhere deep in my psyche, I sort of dismissed Kitty Ferguson as some sort of filler the organizers had thrown in. Maybe the original speaker had canceled or something. Well, I turned out to be off the mark a bit. Most of you have heard of Stephen Hawking. He is widely regarded as the great genius of our time, and many people think he may be the one who will expand on Einstein's thinking and develop a unified theory, a theory which will unify and explain the differences between Newtonian physics and quantum mechanics, and we'll touch on that briefly in just a moment. Stephen Hawking insists that every new member of his research team read Kitty Ferguson's books before joining his team. But not only that, Stephen Hawking's latest book on physics was co-authored by Kitty Ferguson. That is about as credible as anybody's credentials can get. Kitty Ferguson spent most of her time looking back instead of looking forward, setting the stage for what was to come. She explained how it is we got to know what we know about the universe and the tools astronomers use to map the universe. I was most struck by how new our knowledge is. Up until the 1920s, we thought the Milky Way galaxy was the whole universe. And then Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble Space Telescope is named, figured out that those tiny specks of light which appeared at the edge of the Milky Way were actually themselves entire galaxies with billions of stars each. And there were billions of them. And I thought my mind was pretty well blown by the time she was finished. But the following day, a professor of physics at Columbia named Brian Green took us all in the other direction. As Kitty Ferguson had looked further and further out into the universe, Brian Green looked at smaller and smaller segments of reality. Now, I'll be honest. As I listened to Brian Green, whose book, The Elegant Universe, is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, I alternated between getting cold chills of excitement and a dull headache, accompanied by that little voice that kept saying, "Gary, you're probably not supposed to be thinking about this stuff." Brian Green was the best person I have ever encountered at explaining extremely difficult ideas in a way people can understand. He started out by explaining the universe according to Isaac Newton. Then he explained how Einstein corrected Newton's thinking by determining that space and time are mediums for gravity and that gravity actually distorts the shape of space and time. And this is where that headache made its first appearance. Not because I didn't get it, but because for the first time, he was actually sort of making me understand it. Then he jumped to quantum mechanics, which is one of those subjects I've always enjoyed reading about, even though I have given up on ever really understanding what it is all about. But the whole problem is this. Nature has one set of rules that apply to the world we see, and it acts just like Newton and Einstein said it should. But there's a whole different set of rules when we start looking at smaller and smaller pieces of the universe. Einstein spent most of his life trying to figure out why the universe we see doesn't act like that part of the universe that is too small for us to see. And he failed. And it is this problem that keeps modern physicists awake at night, because it just doesn't make sense. When pressed for where it is that the rules change, how small do we have to get before Newton's physics no longer work? This is the way Green explained it. Envision 1 meter. Now take 1/1,000,000th of that meter. Normal physics still works there. Now take 1/1,000,000th of that. Regular physics still works there. Now take 1/1,000,000th of that. Regular physics still works there. But now take 1/1,000,000th of 1/1,000,000th of 1/1,000,000th of 1/1,000,000th of a meter, and regular physics no longer works. Frankly, I decided not to lose any sleep over this. But Green went on to explain the theory that tiny strings of energy are the base material for all reality. This theory, string theory, appears to solve the problem of why physics operates with two sets of rules. And Green, Brian Green, is recognized as one of the world's leading string theorists, and many speculate that this man, Brian Green, will be the person to ultimately develop a unified theory, the theory that eluded Einstein. The only problem is that while the universe appears to us to have three dimensions, height and width and depth, string theory demands that there be at least six or seven more, probably 11 total. Well, pass the Excedrin and let's move on to the next speaker. I've saved these two for last because they dealt more with the world that you and I live in and how the current trends in science will actually affect us in the future. Michael Marletta is a professor of biochemistry at the University of Michigan. He has received countless awards for his research and discoveries. He taught us about DNA, with special emphasis on that Human Genome Project that was just completed 2 weeks ago. He said the way we should think of the Human Genome Project, which has received so much press lately, is that the field of medicine now has a parts list for the human body. We don't have a manual yet, but finally we have a list of the parts. And now it is the job of the medical field to start writing a manual. And medicine will never be the same. And this leads me to the guy that was probably the most interesting of the scientific speakers at Chautauqua last week, a man named B. Gentry Lee. Lee is a space systems engineer, a science fiction writer, and a futurist. All of the speakers stressed over and over again that the rate of change in our scientific knowledge that we are about to encounter will be like nothing we can imagine. Brian Green, the string theorist, and Michael Marletta, the biochemist, believed that the rate of change the world is experiencing is so rapid, it is absolute folly to attempt to see more than 10 years into the future. Well, our friend B. Gentry Lee, being a science fiction writer, did not feel bound by such constraints. In fact, in his latest book, he pretends to be a historian 100 years in the future who looks back and writes a history of the 21st century. I will share just a few of his predictions with you. If you could leap into the future and walk into a grocery store in the year 2030, 95% of the food you would see would not be recognizable. It will be genetically engineered to be healthier. Various fruits and vegetables will have been crossed to create more efficient foods for the human body. Before the year 2050, people will have tiny microprocessors in their bodies. They will stand in front of a scanner in their homes every morning, and all their vital information will be automatically transmitted to a mainframe. Any irregularities will be detected early, and all information will automatically appear in the doctor's file. By the year 2050, there will be corporations that harvest and fertilize eggs for potential parents who will be able to check the vital statistics of thousands of their own fertilized eggs and pick the one that best suits them. Hair color, eye color, height and weight, those things are no problem. Beyond that, the process will involve odds. This fertilized egg has an 82% chance of being a musical genius. you probably aren't interested in those 13 eggs, but this fertilized egg has a 93% chance of being a mathematical genius, and so on. Parents, we will be able to do this while the fertilized eggs are only a couple of days old, and they will have thousands of their own fertilized eggs to choose from. By the year 2080, human death will have basically been eliminated. Death will occur from accidents, from occasional, unexpected, traumatic illnesses, and by choice. We will each have a list of criteria by which we would choose to continue living. If we don't meet that criteria, we would pick ahead of time, then our lives would be terminated. Well, the good thing about futurists is that they have a track record of being wrong. But they give us some wonderful things and some frightening things to think about. As I close, I want to mention the one thing that it seems most of the speakers agreed on. It was an idea that sort of hung over the whole week as we discussed science and technology as engines of change. And this is a truly amazing thing when you think about it. If the human race manages to survive for a million years, and if then a race of beings from another world came to study the history of our Earth, the time we are living in right now, will be seen as the pivotal moment in the history of our planet. And here is why. History will show that after 3.5 billion years of evolution, it was now, right now, that a product of that evolution, humanity, took control of the process. That's where we are, right now. And we have every reason to be excited, and we have every reason to be very careful. Amen.